following Dharma talk was given by Lawrence Greco at the Interdependence Project in New York City. For more information, please visit www.openskyzen.com.
What happens when we die? What was happening before we were born? What is this thing that some people call God or the universe? Did someone make me? Did someone create me? Why am I here? They're very important questions, but they're not questions that we could answer logically. So while some study helps, some intellectual understanding can be very helpful, reading books can help, going to retreats or classes can be helpful, in the end, the answer is always inside of you. And Zen is really nothing but a collection of teachings and practices that point directly to your true nature, to who and what you truly are. And then once you understand that, then you can deal with whatever comes up in life. It doesn't make life perfect or easier. It's not a magic solution. But it gives us a clarity so that we know precisely what's going on, for real. Not our idea of what's going on. We know what our role is in the situation, and then we know how to respond appropriately to whatever's happening. So a few years ago, I almost ordained with the Western sect of another traditional Korean Zen order called the Taegu Order. So I was in the seminary program for 6 months, and I found out, even though they were ordaining Westerners, they were just ordaining Westerners for the first time, if you are a woman or over the age of 50, or if you are physically challenged in any way, or if you're a lesbian or gay, you cannot be fully ordained as a monk in their order. And they didn't exactly put this out there in the beginning, nor is it anywhere on their website. So I very publicly withdrew from that order, and I blogged about it, and you know, they all, of course, hated me and tried to tell stories about me that were true. So that happened. Hopefully it inspired some change, but I found really the order I'm with is wonderful, and I love my teacher. I love my Dharma brothers and sisters that I've met through the Five Mountain Zen Order. I love being at IDP now. So it all worked out for the best. But just a few days ago on Facebook, of course, where this is like the new forum for everything in life is Facebook. I do a lot of weddings for a living. I officiate weddings. So I meet with couples and I create my custom rite ceremonies for them, and I do the ceremonies, and sometimes they're very Buddhist, sometimes they're not, you know, it's up to them. And I had a photo of myself with a couple I had just married last Saturday in Central Park. So someone from the Taegu Order started pecking away at the fact that I was wearing my traditional red gasa, which signifies my role as a Zen teacher. And for some reason, he thought that I should not be wearing that. Like, he didn't, obviously doesn't know that I am authorized as a Zen teacher. Right? So he started shooting off about that under the picture. That was his comment. Everyone else is like, oh, hell, what a lovely couple. And congratulations to the couple. What a beautiful bride. And he's like, how dare you pose as a monk in that red? And I was like, really, dude? So I responded by, again, I just say what I always say, and I've been saying for 3 years, every time one of them bugs me, I say, look, we all know that the Taegu Order discriminates against women, gay people, and physically challenged people, so you could say whatever. And his response was, and this is a grown man, reasonably intelligent. I met him once or twice a few years ago at some retreats. He actually runs or is involved with a local temple somewhere in the Midwest, so people are coming into contact with this version of the Dharma. So his defense was, the age limit is something that every Buddhist order in Asia observes. It is not discrimination, as you characterized it, but rather a protective measure to ensure that prospective monks are still able to physically perform the obligations of a monk, such as prostrations, etc. Like, do you know what prostrations are? Like, you would start from a standing position, then go to your knees, and then bow, and then back up, and then, you know. Like, that's, if that were my main job, I would suck as a monk. I shouldn't be here. Because I almost never do them, and I'm not going to make you do them. Anyway, Then he said, fourth, people with disabilities are simply not ordained in Asian orders because their disabilities prevent them from fulfilling the obligations of a monk. It is regarded as an act of ego for such a person to presume to be a monk, and I agree with that. How can a person missing digits... I love that he said digits. Fingers, right? But that's true. Just, how can a person missing digits properly perform a mudra, for example? Right? Heaven forbid, I shouldn't be able to do this. Like, we know what a mudra is? A mudra, there are many different hand positions we call mudras, like the cosmic mudra in Zen during meditation is this. Right? There are other ones where you might surround your index finger over your heart like this. That's a mudra. So if I'm missing a finger and I can't do this, I can't be a monk. I can't help people, right?
Missing digits.
According to him.
A couple different ways. So,
oh.
Really? That just occurred to my mind.
Sorry. I didn't think of that. That's all right. So how can a person missing digits properly perform a mudra, for example? Such a person's karma is not monkhood. So he's, you know, the karma police. He knows. Right? You hear that all the time. Karma is one of those words that's so misused and misunderstood, it makes me ill. Like, I hear karma's a bitch. Or, you know. So, that's an example of what Zen is not. That's an example of why people are so turned off to any kind of spiritual practice. That's why it took you how long to even go to a mini, you know, Zen retreat again since then? How many years is that? That's terrible. Whether it was a Zen order or a Catholic church like I was raised in or whatever it is, everyone has a way of missing the whole point and turning people off and forgetting that this is all about how can I help you somehow, right? How can I help you understand your true nature so that you don't have to fumble through life quite as much or maybe a little bit less? Can you be 10% happier? Are you 10% happier after reading that book? That's not bad. Well, I can't promise any percentage of happiness increases after today, tonight or tomorrow, but beyond that, you know, Zen isn't even about happiness, because once you have happiness, then you have sadness, right? Sounds funny. We all want to be happy, and it's perfectly natural to want to be happy. But if we could turn that into a goal we never reach, and then we're stuck in the world of opposites, right, where there's good and bad and happy and sad and all of that. I was reading a wonderful book called The Compass of Zen. It's quite a tome. It's a collection of teachings by one of our root teachers, Zen Master Song Song. And when he talks about Zen, he would sometimes refer to it as a gate. And he would say, to pass through the gate of Zen, do not attach to any thinking that arises in the mind. And so entering this path, right? Entering the gate or passing through the gate of Zen simply means not being beholden to all the thinking that arises in my mind. Now, it doesn't mean I can turn my mind off. It doesn't mean meditation is a state in which you're going to bliss out and not think of anything and just feel serene and happy and just maybe think of clouds and, I don't know, pleasant things. All it is a training to keep coming back to your mind in its most natural, normal state. Your mind before thinking arises. And connecting with that, as opposed to what we usually relate to and attach to, which is every passing thought that comes and goes that my brain decides to crap out at any given moment. And we latch on to that thought, and then we develop a feeling, we have an emotion, and that inspires an action, sometimes a good action, sometimes not such a good action. And we cause lots of harm to ourselves and other people as a result, because we're always letting every passing thought dictate our behavior. And we think, I am nothing but my thoughts, right? Like Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Well, what happens before your thinking? What's that? And how can we come back to that? How can we get glimpses of that? How can we train ourselves to relate more to our minds as they are before thinking than we do to our minds that are constantly shitting thoughts? Because that's mostly what the brain does. And it's in some ways the simplest thing in the world, but also the most complicated thing in the world. It sounds very appealing, but it also seems so daunting. So what we're doing when we're, whatever we do, a little sitting meditation tonight, some walking meditation, if we do some chanting tomorrow, when you leave here tonight, when you're walking down the steps, when you're on the train or walking down the street, when you're going to bed, when you're eating, every aspect of your life is always an opportunity to practice coming back to this mind before thinking arises, connecting with your true nature. So when we connect with that, we realize we're not separate from anything or anyone. This is what people call God or the universe. I think Sung San would call it universal substance or the absolute. Right? So your true nature and everything in the universe are made of the same stuff, made of the same substance. So the more we train in coming back to that, the less stuck we are in the world of opposites and opposite thinking, and seeing everything and everyone as separate and disconnected, as an obstacle to my happiness or a means to my happiness. Maybe this person that can give me the love I feel I need and make me happy, or this job that will give me the money I need to make me happy, or this piece of chocolate cake that can make me happy. Because we're constantly imbuing things with qualities they don't intrinsically have. We're constantly misinterpreting everything we see. So Zen practice trains us in seeing everything as it really is. Without the overlay of our concepts, without the overlay of our thinking, our biases, our fears, our projections. You know, studies have shown that most of what we perceive, perception, is really a process of memory. So even when I'm looking at something, I can look at this stick, right? And I don't just see a stick. Other things come to mind. I was walking down the street with this in my hand, and I get some very funny reactions when I walk around the city with this stick in my hand. People think, is that a weapon? Someone, a few people moved away from me on the subway on the way here. Some people are curious. Some people smile. Some people say, oh, it looks like a Zen teacher stick. So it could be many, many things. And it's a very unusual shape. Look at it, the curves that this wood makes. It's very unusual looking. So then other associations might come to mind. But really all it is this. It's just this. So when we practice, we train ourselves in just coming back. Just coming back. Just seeing things directly and clearly as they are. Not as we fear them to be, or imagine them to be, or hope they'll be, but just as they are. Because Zen is often, we say it originated with a very famous sermon the Buddha gave called the Flower Sermon, where it was much, much later in his teaching. He taught for some 40 years or so. He lived to about the age of 80, the records tell us. And toward the end of his teaching career, he stood in front of an assembly of hundreds of his students who'd been with him for years probably. And for the first time ever, he didn't speak. And instead, he reached down and picked up a flower and held it up before the assembly. and didn't say a word. And this one guy named Mahakashyapa saw this and smiled. And the Buddha handed him the flower and said, I pass on the incomprehensible Dharma to you. This Dharma that does not depend on thinking or words or speech. So in Zen, we like to say that's how the lineage of Zen began. So teachers can be traced back to that moment. So in Zen, we're not really concerned so much with words and speech. You know, some people say to me, you know, I don't really know a whole lot. I haven't read very much. I never meditated before. That's all fine. In some ways, that could be a plus, that you haven't been exposed to a lot of, you know, dharmic gobbledygook. And there is a lot of crap out there you'll hear. You know, if you have 2 feet, if you can see, or if you can hear, or you can taste, you can touch, you can think, you can feel, that's it. You're an excellent Zen student. That's all you need. There's a million ways to do this practice. It's really all about, it's your whole life. It's not some thing you get to do once in a while. It's not something I can give you that you can't do on your own. It's only something I could point to that you already have. It's something that's right there under your nose, but you don't know it yet. There's a very famous legendary figure in Zen named Bodhidharma who was responsible for bringing Zen to China from India. So he arrives in China. He's a very legendary, well-known Zen teacher. And Emperor Wu of China heard that Bodhidharma had just arrived. And Emperor Wu was responsible for creating all kinds of temples and pagodas and stupas, and he would have all of the major Buddhist sutras reprinted on paper and distributed to the public for free. He made Buddhism the national religion of China. So he was very proud of himself for all of this. So he thought, well, surely Bodhidharma is going to want to meet me. So he had his minions bring him to his palace. And Bodhidharma walked in with his big thick beard and his rags, his crappy looking robe, you know, worn and tattered looking, stood before Emperor Wu, not impressed at all. And the emperor said to him, I've created hundreds of stupas and pagodas. I've made Buddhism the national religion of China. I've had all of the sutras printed and distributed for free. So tell me, what merit have I gained? Because after all, that's what Buddhism is about, right? I do good things, and then I'll have a better next life, or even a better this life. So tell me, Bodhidharma, all this stuff I've done, how awesome is my next life going to be? So what merit have I attained? And Bodhidharma said, no merit whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Of course, Emperor Wu was not pleased with this response, and he expected something much different. He said, well, as far as I understand the teachings, it's all about merit and karma and cause and effect, right? And doing good things so that I have a more pleasurable or auspicious life in the next time around, or the time after that even. That's how I've understood the teachings. How do you understand them? And Bodhidharma said, in vast emptiness, there's no holiness. There is no merit. And the emperor said, who do you think you are talking to me that way? And Bodhidharma's response was, don't know. Don't know. So this story illustrates a major shift in Buddhism that's very particular to Zen. So it's not about logic. It's not about doing things and being attached to some outcome. Because that's a form of separation right there. Generosity for the sake of accumulating something. Or, well, if I scratch his back, he'll scratch mine next time. Or if I'm nice to so-and-so. I mean, we all do this. We've manipulated and maneuvered. We've all been manipulated and maneuvered. We thought someone was being nice out of the kindness of their heart, and actually they weren't. And we've all done that to others. Because we're human beings. But understanding we're not separate from anyone or anything else won't give rise to that. So don't know. And he said, don't know. What does that mean?
Did he say, I don't know?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. The way we tell the story is always, don't know. Because we talk, well, yeah, perfectly good question. Yeah, I'll always feel free to ask questions anytime, any of you. You could always jump in, I'm not. So what did that mean when he said, don't know? So up until then, there was a lot of value placed on memorizing sutras, memorizing lessons, right, and formulas. And reciting, you know, the Buddha's words, regurgitating dead words, repeating them. Well, the Buddha said this once. I know people all the time, they quote shit to me, and I'm like, okay, I don't remember that, or I don't know if I ever heard that, but that doesn't really help anyone. And in Zen, we emphasize the opposite of knowing shit, knowing stuff, being logical. Because none of that helps you in the end. Accumulating knowledge is not going to solve the great question of life and death. It's just not going to do it. Right? What happens? Moments before your... I always think sometimes, what's it going to be like when I know I'm going to die, or moments before my death? Am I going to be ready? Or not? So all the reading in the world is not going to prepare us for that. No teacher is going to prepare you for that. A teacher can help point the way so that you're ready for that. But in the end, it's always, the onus is always on you as an individual. So we do this practice not to attain something, not to become something that we're not already. We do this practice to understand what we already are, who we already are. So I'm not my past bad decisions. I'm not my addiction. I'm not my bad or wonderful relationships. I'm not my job title. I'm not my name. Who am I? That's the question we keep at all times. Even more than that, what am I, really? What am I before these thoughts arise, before these concepts take over? Before I feel tugged and pulled around by changing circumstances and the latest craving and the latest desire that I think this is going to do it this time. If I get this or do this, then I'll feel better. And then, yeah, maybe you feel better for 5 seconds or 5 minutes or even 5 years. And then guess what? It's just always back to this. And then we want the next and the next. And that's really exhausting. Zen Master Sung San said once, I don't really teach about Zen or Korean Buddhism or Buddhism at all. I only teach one thing. I only teach only don't know. And he would say constantly, if you read his books or hear some of his lectures, he'd say, just go straight, just go forward, only don't know. So what does that mean? Just go straight, just go forward, only don't know. So this don't know mind we talk about, that's the gateway to our true nature. If I can not attach to every thought that arises in my mind, I can notice it, and not let it take over. And come back to my mind, what's there before that thought came up? Come back to that. If I can keep this mind that's open and fresh and experiencing things directly with curiosity, even if it's, you know, talking to my mother on the phone and hearing her whine about the same thing for the 57th time, I can use that. That's my practice for those few minutes, right? Just, oh, what is this? Oh, okay. Without attaching thoughts about the past or thoughts about how I feel about it or how I feel about her as a mother or how I don't feel about her as a mother. Just experiencing that moment for what it is. We're watching a sunrise or a sunset, and just watching it rather than, oh, it's going to be over soon. The word Zen itself comes from a Chinese transliteration. The word is Chan, C-H-A-N. So a lot of people think Zen means meditation, but more specifically, some would say it means become one like this, which really is meditation. When we hear meditation, we think, well, this is meditation when we're on a cushion and, you know. But becoming one like this is what we can do all the time. To just be fully connected, fully immersed with whatever's going on before us all the time. To just do whatever we're doing 100%, which is harder than ever to do. I think, Jonathan, you mentioned, right? With all the different distractions we have. We have cell phones and text. And there's more things than ever that can now pull us away. Tug our attention this way and that way, but also more opportunity to practice. Or even if we are all over the place, do that 110%, 100%. Even when you are scattered, be fully immersed in your scatteredness and know it. Like, okay, this is, I know I'm being a little, all right, but you're doing it, you know, you're with it. So the point isn't to become some little, you know, Zen robot that's walking slowly all the time and, you know, slowly putting your coffee cup down and then, you know. Now sometimes we're in a rush, but you could be mindful about your rush, right? Someone could be annoying you, but instead of, like, maybe cursing them silently in your head or trying to bolt, if the situation doesn't call for it, just be fully with that annoyance. And be curious about it. What is this? Can I see this with fresh eyes, even though I've heard this story before, or I think I know what's going on? Maybe I don't know. So if I can keep returning to my don't know mind, this mind that's open to possibility, open to potentiality, that's fresh, like a child's mind, if I can keep coming back to that mind, that is our natural mind, believe it or not. It just gets kind of conditioned out of us as we get older. And you see it so clearly sometimes in children. Right? Well, they'll find a common household object and it could become anything. It could become a cooking pot, it could become a hat, it could become an instrument, it could become a weapon, it could become a step, it could become a chair. You know. But over time, we see a pot as just a pot. That's it. I don't know, I have all these notes and I never really look at them much anymore. I kind of shut that up. Yeah, so everything we're going to do tonight, the short time we have together, tomorrow, if you're here again, but more importantly, throughout your everyday life, right? Starting like right now, tonight, tomorrow, whether I see you sometime again in the future or not, you can always use whatever's happening as your practice. Just becoming one with this. Becoming one with whatever's happening. So yes, there are some remedial qualities to meditation, and most of us, like I mentioned earlier, we come to this practice because things are not good, right? Some serious shit is going down. We're really stressed out. I know one of my favorite teachers is a woman named Jerry Larkin, who started the Still Point Zendo in Michigan some years ago. She's more or less retired now, but she's written many books. She's really wonderful. And actually, my first Zen teacher was her teacher as well. And she says all the time, what brought her around to meditation was that she had a twitch in her left eyelid. It was just twitching a lot. And her doctor said, you know what, you might want to learn how to meditate. So that was that small an issue for her. And she was like a high-powered business person, like making tons of money, like, you know, always working, always, in, you know, one of those business types. And now she's just a full-time, she lives alone, and she writes her books. She lives a simple life, and she's very happy and really cool in her 60s now. She changed, she gave all that up. She doesn't work anymore. But we don't have to do that either. I'm not going to do that. So it could be something that small that brings us around, or it could be a devastating life experience, right? Where we're just fed up. I know I came to this because I was really fed up. I was fed up with the kinds of relationships I was having. I was fed up with the ups and downs, right, of my emotions and my mind states. And fed up with all of it. So that's good when that happens. We need something like that to bring us around. So in the end, it comes down to, you know, all of these practices, if we can understand our true nature, if we can understand our mind as it is before thinking arises, if we can connect with that, then we're connecting with everything. That's the God experience everyone's talking about, as if God is some separate entity living on a cloud somewhere. No, not really, you know? You can experience God when you're drinking coffee or having sex or walking, running down to the subway. It's always right there. We don't use the word God too much because it's such a charged word. That word got ruined long ago. So if we develop that kind of clarity, that kind of clear seeing, then our role in life becomes very clear. We don't have to be confused. Lauren?
So much of the philosophy is about an absence of doctrine. How do you learn?
Excellent. So, doctrine, well, you mentioned, Philip mentioned philosophy before, right? So philosophy is where thinking begins. So philosophy gives us a lot of interesting ideas about the world, or a way to view the world, a way to approach the world, or, you know, you could look at it this way. Or perhaps this is really what's going on. This could be my framework for approaching everything in the world. Or I could learn about, in Buddhism, what the Buddha said, what suffering is, what dukkha is, and what causes it, and how we extinguish it. I could learn all of that and memorize it and recite it. Many, many people can. But in the end, our thinking doesn't really save us, our thinking minds. Now, we have to think strategically every day in all kinds of ways. And that's appropriate. We solve problems at work. We negotiate our way out of here to get home or to our next set of plans. Right? We're always, so thinking is wonderful. Thinking does many wonderful things. But understanding our true nature, understanding who am I, what am I really, my thinking mind is not going to do that. Doctrine is not going to do that. Right? Someone telling, even my words to you, aren't going to do that. We say Zen and Zen teachings are like a finger pointing at the moon. So all I'm doing is I'm pointing at the moon. You don't want to get fixated on the finger. If you look at the finger, that's not going to help you. Look at what I'm pointing at, what I'm pointing at. And unfortunately, in this human form, all I have are words or this silly prop once in a while or exercises or, you know, practices or a diet or whatever. So that's what I mean. Marcel?
Would you say that understanding Zen is more of an intuitive process?
I'd say it's really experiential. It's just, you know, we talk about our true nature. My fear is that I'm giving this impression that there's this true nature and it's somewhere and we can maybe locate it at some point. Like if we practice well enough, or, you know, we come back to our before thinking mind and, oh, there is my true nature. There it is. It's tucked under my left shoulder. There it is, under the scapula. This true nature I'm talking about is not so much a thing or another version of the big self we like to pump up so much. It is, maybe think about the nature part, right? It's the nature of the sun to shine. It's the nature of a tree to be born and grow and die and be born and grow and die. So a tree always knows its job. Every element of nature always understands its job. Right? Dogs just bark. Nature does its thing. The seasons always do their thing more or less on time, even if we don't love the weather. Right? It is now summer. It feels a little more like summer now. It feels different than it did a month ago. So it's connecting with that energy that informs all of this going on. Right? So nature, what's different between us and, say, a dog when it's barking, or a tree when it's growing, or the sun when it's shining, is that we have these thinking brains. So, again, they're remarkable, they're wonderful, and they create everything from cures for diseases, the means to travel into outer space, beautiful artwork and literature, all kinds of wonderful things. But a lot of what it creates too, or these brains of ours create, is thinking and reflecting. Oh, I don't know, should I do this? I don't know, this just seems too risky. This is the kind of life I want, but if I do this, then what will people think? Oh, I don't know, but my parents want me to do this, and my wife and my husband are mine. Right? And we stumble. And then the most beautiful aspects of nature, they're not thinking and reflecting and second-guessing themselves. They're just doing their thing. And we all have something to do, but we're blocking ourselves because we're so disconnected. We're attached to our thinking so much. So some people's nature is going to express itself as a president, or a bricklayer, or a barista, or a sex worker. Right? Could be anything. I don't know. Celebrity.
It's hard for me to articulate it because it seems like I just intuitively grasp a lot of it by now. But when I was first exposed to Zen, it was actually through a book by Daisen T. Suzuki, Zen and Japanese Culture. And he had these stories that would illustrate, you know, his Dharma points, or I guess he called them Dharma stories before.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always stick in my mind. And for years after I read that in college, they would always stick in my mind until I actually came to Zen practice. And then I started to say, oh, I see what you meant. But it's hard to actually explain it. So that's what I mean.
That's what the dilemma is.
Yeah.
Because Zen is a practice that's beyond words and speech.
Exactly. Yeah.
But here we are. I'm explaining this with words and speech. So the second we try to name it, we're already making a mistake. The second I talk about your true nature, I'm already limiting it because I named it. Or I talk about emptiness or the universe or God. The second you say those words, you're already not, you're cutting it off and you're making it separate. So it is hard to explain. I think I have a very simple, like my elevator explanation for Zen. What do I say? I say Zen is the process of understanding your true nature through consistent practice, so that love and compassion can arise naturally. Try that one out. I think it's on my website. I haven't been to my own website in a long time.
You get to know yourself. Yeah, you explain it very well, actually.
Who else has something to ask or say? Warren.
Well, how do you get to the state? I missed it. Where you're you know, one with things and you're not thinking.
What's going on right now? What's going on right now?
I wonder if I missed something because my mind was wandering, and so.
The mind's good at that, isn't it? That's okay. No, I put you on the spot for a reason. But this is what happens to us all the time, so you're not unique in that, right? Very simply, what's going on right now? That's all it is. So this, like, that's a perfectly valid question, right? I'm talking about our minds before thinking, right? Our true nature, connecting with universal substance or God. So how do we do it, right? What's going on right now? Can someone tell me what's going on right now? What, just
lots of stuff.
Maybe a little more specific.
We're listening to you speak.
Yeah. That's it.
I'm breathing.
Mm-hmm.
The sun burns at Jake.
You what?
The sun burns at Jake.
You feel your sun burn at Jake? Uh-huh.
You feel the air conditioner?
Uh-huh. That's it. What's going on right now is it. Because in each and every moment, this is all of it right here. This is an expression of truth. Like, we're all looking for this big capital T truth or this God experience or this profound enlightenment experience. Actually, that's all enlightenment is, you know. All it is being connected fully to what's going on and not separate from it. So the Buddha, as enlightened as he apparently was, he understood that. That was his big revelation. That was enlightenment. Enlightenment doesn't mean you're suddenly the wisest person in the world, or that you can recite, you know, Buddhist scriptures, or that you can heal people with your hands. You know, he really could have been, probably was, a racist, misogynist, homophobe. You know why? Because he was around 2,500 years ago, and based on his situation, and his culture, and history, that's probably the best he could do. And yet he was enlightened. Does that make any sense? So enlightenment doesn't mean you become, you know, a person I agree with politically. Enlightenment has nothing to do with our ideas or our political agendas or our concepts or our philosophies. He might have been a complete prick, for all we know. Really. So don't even attach to this guy. He's a wonderful example of what you already are. That's all. That's why we have this here, you know. We're not worshiping some dead man in this nice, bejeweled, golden rendering. This is simply a reminder of what you already are. So this isn't a practice about becoming something else. It's a practice of realizing, oh, I'm already this. I'm already this. So yes, I have thoughts that are very discursive. I have emotions that tug me all over the place. I go through depressions. I have serious cravings and addictions. I have a bad temper. I do. So that can all happen there, but if we don't relate to that and latch onto it and let it pull us around like an ox by its nose ring, like they would tug a cattle around. When we practice, it's like we lose that nose ring and we're not pulled around anymore. So the stuff is still there, but we're not relating to it. We're not being tugged around by it. Like a dog with a collar or a leash around its neck. And that doesn't even mean I feel great all the time. I mean, you could still feel crappy. I don't feel good all the time by any means. But the way I relate to that is so different than it was 10 years ago. It doesn't take me over. It doesn't have to take me over. And when it does, I learn from it and I try again. I come back to who I really am.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. For more information about Lawrence Greco, please visit www.openskyzen.com.